I'm Greg Johnson. Welcome to Countercurrents Radio. Returning today is Patrick LeBrun. Patrick and I are going to be talking about what's been happening in Europe, specifically terrorism, and how this is going to possibly affect the electoral fortunes of the Front National. It's certainly impacting the electoral fortunes of Donald Trump right now, so I have high hopes that it'll be good for the right in Europe as well. So, Patrick, welcome to the show.
Yeah, thank you very much for having me. And also, I'd like to begin by saying I've been missing in action for a few months. I've had a little bit more family health stuff to deal with, and that plus work, which just made participation not possible. But I hope to be much more present again in the months to come.
Well, that's great. You've got a lot to add, so I really appreciate that. Everyone should check out Patrick's most recent article from this past Friday about fascism. We need to go, though, into what's been happening recently. Every time I try and organize an interview about some atrocity, some new atrocity comes along and knocks it off the headlines. So this is difficult. We're living in interesting times, as the Chinese say. The most recent terrorist attack, of course, was in Germany.
Yeah.
But when we talked about doing this, the thing that was fresh in our minds was the absolute atrocity on Bastille Day in Nice. So I would like to try and focus in on that, especially, and the French scene, since you're most familiar with that. So do you want to give us some background there?
Sure. I mean, for me, I was back in France for a period of time before the attack. And it was a time, I think that, the security services there and also myself personally were a bit on high alert because there was the European Football Cup, which was really a major target. There was a plot that was foiled put together by a cell in Brussels in the early days of that tournament. I think there were about 20 arrests, if I remember correctly. And it was expected to be big and really big. And thank goodness it didn't happen. And then also there's a festival, a really lovely, lovely festival that happens across the country called the Festival of Music. And that's on the 21st of June, the longest day in the year. And that's where you have both, major organized gatherings where people listen to, they have a main stage, they have professional musicians. And also anybody, if you have an acoustic guitar, if you have a trumpet or whatever, and you just want to people to hear what you can do, you walk out in the corner and you start playing. And it's, it's really just a lovely tradition and a great expression of, positive public life. And, I was in a place in Toulon, which is a city of about 100,000 in the south of France, sitting there in the plaza and just thinking like, man, this place, they're sitting ducks. The security was very light. I think that most of the security for the past couple years, when you see actual armed soldiers walking around with their rifles, that's at transit places. That's at Charles de Gaulle. That's at, the major train stations. But these kinds of public events, it's pretty light. It's six guys marching in two groups of three is not going to stop something like this. And it was a big plaza next to a major boulevard. And the exact same thing that happened in Nice could have happened there. It happened, as it turns out, less than a month later on Bastille Day in Nice. And it's it was really, truly, truly horrific. I wonder about the details of it. The guy had a truck that he smashed through a lot of people. He had a weapon that he did. Fought against those who were trying to kill him as well when he's trying to stop. But he also had tons of, grenades and bombs and other rifles in the back of his truck. I wonder if he was the only one of a cell of guys who didn't chicken out at the last minute. And that there was actually a plan for much more carnage than what happened. They're still in the process of sewing it up. And once again, like with so many of these attacks where it's homegrown in France, it's a guy who was a petty thug. He was a petty criminal. He had no history of, Islamic piety. He probably at some point hoped to turn his life around and, after failed marriage and his career not turning out the way he'd like it to be. And it's just, it's really hard to be a devout Muslim. And I think, especially for a guy with no discipline like him. And so there's always, though, you know, there's a plan A, there's a plan B. Well, in Islam, when plan A doesn't work, you go to plan J, and that's jihad. And that's something built into their system where you can be still be a good Muslim if you can't manage praying five times a day and following all the rules. And that is you just kill the enemies of Islam. And for the Islamic State, they have been targeting France at the top of their list since their beginning. Every time you see them speaking to the camera, they always list France first, because I think for two reasons. One, the most important is that France is the most important place where nationalists could rise. And there have already been concessions to nationalists done by the centrist parties in place, you know, preventing the hijab in schools and in other public places. That's the most important of these. You know, that's based in one of the values of the revolution, right? One of the values that's considered okay in France, and that's secularism. And it's a vision of secularism that's very different than the American vision of secularism. But yeah, you know, keeping the hijab out of the public places. And then I think another way is that, you know, France is, you know, it's a country of over 60 million. If France goes nationalist, that's a lot more important in terms of world politics than Austria going nationalist or Denmark going nationalist. The historical reason is that when Arabic people talk about the Crusades, they don't say when the Catholics came or when white people came. They say when the Franks came. And so I think that, you know, the French have this kind of, you cast a shadow over Muslim history in a way that, you know, even though, you know, the Crusaders came from many different places in Europe, for them it was the Franks. And who was it that stopped them going into Europe? It was, you know, at Poitiers, you know, in terms of Western Europe. And so it's the Franks. So I think there's also this kind of, you know, I guess a historical boogeyman that is stalking the promised dominance of Islam that Allah promised them, right? That if they come to Allah, that they will find success. This is an every call to prayer. And so, an incredible carnage. I think it hasn't been shown on television, but in the hours afterwards, I'm sure a lot of people saw it on social media, just how terrible it was.
Right. I'd like to go back to something you said, which is very good at refuting sort of one of the talking points of the left, the talking points of the establishment who are trying to evade the Islamic nature of these things. They say things like, oh, these bombers aren't good Muslims. They're not pious Muslims. You know, they drink alcohol and listen to rap music and things like that. First of all, I don't know that rap music is haram, but maybe it is. It should be.
If there's only a drum and a voice, it should be okay, I think, as long as...
Okay, you see...
Once you add a guitar track or something, then, yeah, it's haram.
Okay. Well, the point, though, is that, yeah, of course, they're not strictly observant Muslims lot of times. That doesn't mean they don't think they're Muslims. And it doesn't mean that they don't feel bad about being strictly observant.
Yeah.
And it doesn't mean that they might not observe Islam in other ways that are easier, like killing people and blowing themselves up as a way of atoning for their decadent Western lifestyles.
Yep.
So the idea that these aren't good Muslims and therefore, you know, all we need to do is push more decadence on these people and they'll stop detonating is actually quite false. The more decadent these people become, the more guilty they might feel, and the more they want to seek some apocalyptic, destructive form of atonement, and that is Plan J, as you put it, jihad.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I think we've all watched you know, the documentary Defamation.
Right.
And, you know, if we were to say, okay, well, how does this look in other religions? There was a great interview with an Orthodox rabbi saying that, you know, he said fighting anti-Semitism is not a mitzvot, right? It's not an action that brings you blessings, right? Or that is a holy action. But, you know, you have these very wealthy secular Jews who are not, you know, very Jewish in the religious sense. And so how do they make up for that? Well, they give money to the ADL. They make, you know, a deal about these events that the ADL focuses on. This was a guy who was very critical of the ADL. And he said, yeah, I mean, you know, maybe sometimes it's good they focus on this, but, you know, that's really totally different from what we're about. And I think that that's the position that, let's say, those in Muslim, you know, in Muslim religion who are trying to move beyond jihad are trying to make that same point. But here's the problem. The Quran is not like the Bible for most Christians. The Quran is more like, say, the Eucharist for Catholics, because the Quran is the dictation. It's a recitation of what God said to Muhammad. It's not inspired word. It is a dictation. And so, and also, you know, it is an article of faith that Muhammad was the best of men. And so whatever Muhammad did, as is written in the Hadith, is the example for all men to follow. And Muhammad was not a good guy, by our standards, and I think probably by the standards of his time, apart from his criminal band. You know, no one would see this as a good thing. And he engaged in this sort of thing, mass murders, women and children. And, yeah, so I think that there, the even the most well-meaning Muslim who wants to focus on, you know, moderating his religion from the get-go, that's designed out of the system. Certainly in Sunni Islam.
Right. Another talking point that you get out of leftists is all Islam needs is some sort of reformation.
Right.
Right. Well, I mean, that's so naive in two ways. First of all, the Reformation in Europe was a profoundly destructive thing. It unleashed centuries of warfare and the destruction of religious institutions and art and so forth. It was catastrophic. It was a catastrophic wave of terror, of Taliban-like violence and terror that went through Europe because of the Reformation. Yeah, so all we need is another Reformation, you know, a piece of cake, you know. Well, Europe barely survived the first Reformation. Do we really want to be the staging ground for the Islamic Reformation? No, I think not. And the other thing is that Islam has already had its Reformation. Its Reformation is Wahhabism.
Right.
And that's the main problem here, right?
Yeah, that, you're absolutely right. You know, I remember clicking on a link in the Daily Mail once, and, you know, I saw the headline about a tree that was planted by one of the apostles was chopped down and vandalized for the second time in its history by, and it said, you know, this time by atheists or something. And I thought to myself, you know, I bet I know who it was the first time. I bet it was, you know, Cromwell's guys. And sure enough, I clicked through and you're like, yeah, who would have guessed that, you know, I think now, like, you know, any Christian now, if you said the people who chopped down this tree planted by this apostle would have been Christians, they would kind of look at you funny. But yeah, that was the, you know, the kind of Protestant dissenter, approach. And, you know, Ibn Wahhab famously began his movement for purification of Islam with a very similar act. There was a tree in Arabia where women who wanted to get pregnant would go and they would, I don't know, leave a note or do something, right? Saying, you know, that they wanted to be fertile. And he chopped this tree down. And this began a wave of iconoclastic destruction, the destruction of a lot of graves of important people in Islamic history, and a refocusing, saying that, okay, you know, back to the basics of, what was it, the 7th century, and back to the basics of how, you know, Muhammad and his followers lived and following them as an example. And everything created since then by, you know, the culture that existed, the civilizations that existed within Islam, is to be cast aside or to be put in a second place. You know, let's remember, when we talk about the Islamic Golden Age, we're not talking about, for the most part, we're not talking about Sunnis. If, you know, we're talking about the Fatimid Empire in Egypt was a very a mystical Shia version that the Aga Khanis, you know, are the descendants of that today. Sunnis had nothing to do with it, and certainly not the kind of Sunnis that dominate in the Muslim world today, both in numbers and in thought.
Right, right. I believe it was V.S. Naipaul in one of his books on Islam who wrote that one of the most profoundly destructive things about Islam was that basically all the peoples who were Islamized ceased to regard their own cultural heritage as important.
Right.
And I think the way he put it is that only the sands of Arabia are important again. Right. And
yeah.
What Wahhabism has done is it's gone one further. It's only the sands of Arabia in the 7th century are important. Even Arabic culture since then has to be wiped away. What a lovely religion, and what a profoundly destructive religion that is.
Yeah.
And, of course, the trouble with going back to the holy example of Muhammad is that Muhammad basically lived a gangster rap lifestyle. He was worse than that. He was a criminal. It's not the kind of reformation that people think they want.
But they imagine, like the Episcopalians of Connecticut, I think, when they think about the Reformation. You know?
Right. They don't think about the Episcopalians who were closing down monasteries and destroying art.
Yeah, I think, what's his name? E. Michael Jones, he refers to it as a raiding party for barons. That's what the first move of the Reformation was that. And, I think there's a lot of aspects of Protestant culture that I respect. I think of the people who moved to the Cevennes Mountains in France and who were essentially declaring themselves their own priest warriors. There's something really admirable about that and scraping out an existence there in the narrow valleys. But when it came to the very first birthing of this Reformation, it really was an elite strategy to take power away from sacred authority and concentrate it in secular authority. And we haven't even talked about how many folks died in Germany or what percentage of them died in the 30-year war. It was totally, totally devastating for them. It took them centuries to recover.
So let's bring it up to date. After the atrocity, the Muslim massacre in Nice on Bastille Day, what did the French establishment say? What could they say? And what was the reaction from the French people?
Well, I think that this is, truly the case that the government could not be more unpopular, even with this. I think when I was last on Red Ice Radio, I joked about the falling approval rating for the president. And I said that pretty soon it's just going to be his mother and his barber. And little did I know that the barber was making 10,000 euros a month and traveling with the president. There must be like a happy ending involved with this. So the day of Bastille Day began with an annual interview with the president, and he had to address this, he's a head of state, and this is the issue he has to address. These are the issues before the people, and he's brought it there. He's brought it there through his mismanagement of government and his corruption. And the only thing he got really excited about in this little interview in the morning was how we have to stop the FN and the rise of hatred in Europe. Then the next part of his day was riding with the military parade along the Champs-Élysées in Paris, and he was booed as he went down. Booed from the right and from the left. They're actually leftist clowns dancing in the parade route trying to stop him. And when I say leftist clowns, I don't mean, a bunch of jerks who were communists. I mean literally guys with red noses and big shoes who are leftists dancing around the streets to stop him and being cheered on by the people when they're doing this. And then after the attack, when his motorcade went down the street in Nice and passed by the site, he was booed. And when Manuel Valls, the prime minister, went there, he was booed as well. After the Charlie Hebdo attacks, his approval ratings jumped from, I think, in the mid-20s up to 50. It was pretty high. It was over 50%, if memory serves. And now his approval ratings were 12%, and they're basically about the same. So imagine this again. 12% of the country approves of the president of the country. I mean, how his government stands, I have no idea. We could talk a bit more about how the challenges of his government in the past year, and also how, unfortunately, I think that the FN is behind the eight ball strategically as the next year's election approaches.
How is that the case?
Yeah. Well, so the way for the FN to win. So systematically, the way that the elections work in France is there's a first round where all of the parties contest. And then there's a second round, which is a runoff. And in the presidential, it's always a runoff between the top two. And so you had the case where, you know, for example, the last time the FN was in the second round, it was Jean-Marie Le Pen against Jacques Chirac, who was a center-right guy. And what happened was the socialists, there was a huge scandal around very, very serious corruption. And that resulted in the Socialist Party having a very low vote. The left was very divided. And Jean-Marie Le Pen made it to the second tour. I think it was like 17% that he got, you know, in the first round. And so it was a very low percentage that got him in the second tour. And he didn't gain any votes in the second tour, as it turned out. Basically, whoever voted for him the first week voted for him the second week. And Jacques Chirac created this amazing Republican front to stop the rise of fascism, you know. You know, this time around, what Marine Le Pen needs is, again, a divided left and a united left, because the united left is not, even if they were all at it together, they've really fallen out of favor in general, and a divided center right, because she does not want to face the center right in the second tour. Even though more and more union members, in fact, the FN is the number one party amongst every trade union except for one. And it's the number one party of the working class. But still, it's not taking enough votes away from the socialists, or, you know, from the Socialist Party when the Socialist Party isn't present in the second tour, to beat the center-right party, which is called the Republicans now, to beat them in the second tour. So it's a little complicated. I hope I explained it succinctly enough. But that's what she needs. And as it turns out, it's going to be the exact opposite case. The left will be totally divided. The Green Party left the Socialist Coalition over a year ago. The Radical Party of the Left, which is mostly focused on secularism. They're the ones, it was their minister who wrote the gay marriage law and the gay adoption law. And so, you know, their main focus is on de-Catholicizing France, let's say. And they've been around for over 100 years doing that. They left the coalition, I think just last month. And the socialists stand alone. In fact, also the socialists faced a vote of no confidence challenge earlier this spring because of some labor law reforms that Hollande had proposed. And they actually only won that challenge by two votes. So his own party is totally divided. There was a united labor union march last month as well. I think it was on the 22nd of June. It's really, really bad for the left. And here's the thing for the center right. For the first time in their history, they're going to have a primary election. And as long as they vote for anybody but Sarkozy, then the centrist party will not go rogue and present their own guy. So that's a really tough bill to face. Anyway, your thoughts.
What would be better if they had an election sooner or later?
That's a good question. And I don't know the answer to that. I think that, here's my fear about the FN. Amongst the elites and the activists in the party, they're really very anti-EU, anti-Euro, and these are unpopular positions in France. And they've really felt the wind in their sails after Brexit. And so they've been talking more and more about that. I did an interview about a year ago with the head of the party in Toulouse, head of the FN in Toulouse. And he said to me in like a sort of a moment of candor, he's like, you know, we spent all this time on like white papers about all these different issues and showing that we're not a one-issue party and talking about, you know, all kinds of things, having an opinion about them. But at the end of the day, for the French guy or lady who thinks about politics for 5 minutes twice a year, they're going to think too many Arabs vote FN. And at the end of the day, when we finally come to power, it's going to be because of that. And so, you know, the more, even for, you know, dyed-in-the-wool nationalists. You know, I think it's just easier. You feel more comfortable talking about economics. You feel more comfortable talking about sovereign structures and this kind of thing than you do about the hard issues of race and religion. And it's a real threat, I think, that they would start focusing on these other things. I think that the terror attacks will refocus them. But yeah, they need to stay utterly focused on, if you want to protect Europe for the Europeans, then you need to vote for the FN and not about, you know, France and the franc and the EU. You know, I think something like a third of the electorate never even, you know, earned a paycheck in francs, you know? So this is kind of speaking Greek to them, you know, like they don't understand what the point of this.
Rightists love to get lost in monetary policy issues, and
yeah,
we should have our monetary policy issues all worked out in our own heads and have white papers and plans prepared if we ever get into power. But the idea of running a campaign like, say, Ron Paul did about monetary issues guarantees that you'll end up with the fervent support of about 0.2% of the population. If autists were the majority in society, that might work, but it's simply not the case.
Right, right. You know, I actually listened just recently to the debate between Ann Richards and George W. Bush.
Mm-hmm.
George W. Bush was first running for governor. And it was really interesting to hear. She was, I think that, you know, most people there considered her an able administrator. She was well respected in her state. And she had all this dirt on Bush that she was using as well. And the whole time I was listening, I was thinking, you know, how would Donald Trump have said what she just said? You know? And she was talking about his failed businesses and, you know, whatever. But the way she said it was kind of, you know, in a short, droning way. It was very fact-based. She could have just said, you know, are you going to vote for bankruptcy Bush or are you going to vote for me? You know? Or some way of making it just really approachable, well-branded. And it might have been a very different outcome. We might have never had George W. Bush, you know, as a you know, man on the world stage. And that's the thing about politics is, you know, democracy is really appealing to the lowest common denominator or very close to it. And so, yeah, that's the way it's going to have to run. You know, and the more attacks there are, you know, obviously the more people will think of the FN. But I think that for the baby boomer generation in France, when they are nostalgic, and this is very different from the baby, you know, the supposed nostalgia of the baby boomers who voted for the Brexit. You know, they were thinking of an England where factories were open, where, you know, there was national pride and patriotism across all social classes, where you talked to your neighbors and understood each other. You know, it wasn't a Tower of Babel society that they have now. Whereas if you're talking about nostalgia in France, the 30 glorious years, they call it, you know, you're talking about Gaullism. You're talking about, you know, a center-right government that had a sympathetic ear for the needs of labor. And unfortunately, the center-right candidate who's probably going to win, a guy named Alain Juppé, who just so happens to be a white-collar criminal, as it turns out, he actually even fled the country when his case was being reviewed. He went to Canada and he worked as a professor for a time to avoid, you know, just in case he had to face prison time. He is the number one candidate. And if he's the guy, he really taps into that nostalgia. And unfortunately for these baby boomers, they're just so closed-minded that they can't. Those who have not already come to the FN, it's hard to imagine many more coming to the FN from that generation. That's a big challenge. The only hope I think we have is that in the socialist primary, that a new candidate emerges who can unite the left, and that somehow maybe Sarkozy decides to run on the right and gets and wins, or that the center-right guy gets discredited in the meantime. Which is hopefully can happen in the media environment that there is in France. It's hard to imagine now, but yeah, that's the only way that, because the thing is, the FN is the most popular party in France, but it's the most popular party in France with 25%. So actually arriving in power, where you need to get 50% of the vote plus one, that's still a long hurdle to make.
Yeah, that's a fairly sobering prospect. You know, you say that democracy is, you know, appealing to the least common denominator, but we should emphasize that on most of the important issues, actually the least common denominator is right. Most Yes. people are not comfortable with non-white immigration. They're just not. If we had direct democracy in France or the United States, if people could get on their computer mm-hmm. and do a referendum about immigration, it would be over.
Yeah. Yeah. And this is the major promise of a Marine Le Pen presidency, is that there's a list, I think, of about five referenda that she's promised to put forth to the people. And that's a way that she can work around Parliament, which will certainly hope for her failure. They want to maintain a monopoly on power and prevent the FN from doing anything successful. But she can have a referenda, and one of those promised are moratorium on immigration. And also as the, you know, the head of state, foreign policy basically belongs to her. And so dealing with the refugee crisis, she has a lot of leeway if she's president to deal with that without the oversight or legislation from Parliament. So yeah, those things can be dealt with by her. It'll in fact be the most democratic presidency or most democratic government that there's been in France ever. Because as it is now, there's still many layers of representation between the people and actual rule. If the FN is elected, ironically, it will be the most democratic government in France.
Well, that doesn't surprise me, because they're giving the people what they want.
Yeah.
That is what democracy is all about. And it just so happens that in this case, the people want the right thing.
Yeah. Yeah. That's right. Yeah. Yeah, so the thing about the one guy who might emerge on the left, their primary, I think it's in January, if I remember correctly, January or February, and this is also very new for the socialists. They've only done it, I think, twice before, had a primary. And really watching the 2008 primary in the United States, I think, inspired a lot of the French public and captivated their attention. And made the party bosses think, like, okay, maybe this is something we should, you know, give a shot here. And it's better than just choosing from amongst ourselves. You know, we might have a better shot at power that way. And so there, Hollande has announced, no one else has announced for the socialists. It's Emmanuel Macron, who's Jewish and a former Rothschild banker, who is I think he's the Minister of Economy. Very well liked. I think he's the only one in the cabinet who has a high profile and who has a high approval rating. And I think he can seduce a lot of the older female voters of France, because his wife, I think she was actually his teacher when he was 17. He's married to a woman who's, I think, 24 years older than himself. And I think that'll be a big part of his appeal to that crowd, honestly, to win them over. The cat lady vote, I guess you could say, in American terms. And if he can win that socialist primary, then I think that there would be enough of a blank slate that he could unite enough of the left to get to the second tour. And Marine Le Pen will be in the second tour without a doubt. You know, there's no doubt in my mind that she will be in the second tour next March in the presidential elections. The big problem is who's going to be first place, right? And that's either going to be the center-right party or the center-left party. And then when that happens, if it's the center-left party, her chances of winning the presidency suddenly become real. So that's that's the challenge they face. I mean, the tempo of attacks now is so amazing. I mean, it's almost two, three times a week. You know, there was today there was the attack in this mall in Munich. There was the knife wielding man. What was it, Wednesday or Tuesday, on a train in Germany? I mean, the list goes on. The tempo, and I don't see any reason why the tempo of attacks will slow down. Hopefully, whether the FN will be more credible than the center right in the minds of the majority of voters in the primary is hard to say because they're so easily duped. Sarkozy promised them to steam clean the ghettos, and he did nothing of the sort. And in fact, he was worse. He was worse than Hollande when it comes to immigration, when it comes to promoting multiculturalism in France. But people still believe he was a tough guy now, even today. And so it's a question of how you can convince these baby boomers of who's best to deal with the issue. Is it this white collar criminal who did a nice job running Bordeaux and who they know they're comfortable with? Or is it going to be this political outsider who has a very politically incorrect father?
Right. That's a really interesting question. So is there polling that shows jumps for the Front National after each terrorist attack? Or is this just apocryphal? Is this just us based on our intuitions?
That's a good question. You know, I haven't seen it. Doesn't mean it's not out there. I haven't seen that if it exists. So that would be interesting to know. Because, you know, I see approval ratings of different members of the political scene in France. But I don't know. So it's done on a very regular basis for the president, for the prime minister. I don't know if they do it on a regular enough basis with Marine Le Pen to know precisely if that happens or not. But that would be very interesting to see. And I also, the dynamics of the terrorist attack effect has changed because, like I said, a year and a half ago, there was a huge bump for the president and a will towards national unity, and that's totally gone now. So the way people react to a public event at one point will be different at another point so far. But yeah, go ahead.
Even dead cats get a bounce, as people like to say. And so Hollande is deader than a dead cat.
That's right. Yeah, he certainly is. Yeah.
So let's talk about Brexit and let's talk about Trump, especially in connection with the Front National. It was very interesting after the Brexit vote went through. Liberals around Europe and America were saying things that sort of surprised me, but it was a peek into their minds. This one liberal said, "Look, if Brexit can happen, Trump can get elected, and if Trump can get elected, Marine Le Pen can get elected." And I thought, yeah, basically, that's right. Has Brexit given nationalism in France a bump? And how is Donald Trump playing in France? Two questions, I guess.
Sure, yeah. I think that the biggest impact of Brexit in France is on the confidence of activists on the nationalist and patriotic side. You work so hard, and look, this is your life too. Huh? You work so hard, and you're working based on hope. You know, you want something that America hasn't seen before, you know. And it's and every day you wake up, you're facing a challenge ahead of you again. Okay, I'm gonna, push this rock up the hill and hope for something that we haven't seen in our lifetimes. And I think for the activists in France, this is close enough to their struggle, even if they're not, wanting to have the end of the EU or the Euro, that they say, okay, big changes like this are possible, and outdoing the elite and the oligarchs is possible. And I think that more than affecting the people, Brexit really gave a great deal of hope and to the activists. Absolutely, absolutely. In terms of Trump, the thing about French media is that, imagine the things that are most negative about America written in the New York Times. Well, this is the only thing that gets translated and then recounted to the French people. Everything else, any kind of nuance, the other side of the story, whatever it might be, is not told to them. I was at a wedding with, a lot of people who were more on the left, let's say, and not so, and who had never been to America, didn't know very well. And we were talking about the Eagles of Death Metal lead singer. The Eagles of Death Metal were planning to be, at two different events this summer in France in two major rock festivals, right? Like all one of these all day Saturday things, you know, we have 20 bands and three stages or whatever. And they were kicked off of that because the lead singer gave a tour, gave an interview, and he was talking about how, you know, the security that night, only one out of six guys showed up to work. And he thought it might have been an inside job. And the one guy who showed up was not paying it. He wasn't looking at the band when they walked by. He was looking around, looking at other stuff. And then, you know, to me, I've never been in a rock band. I've never been backstage. I have no idea how a security guy acts. But if you're, you know, 5 days, 6 days a week for 9 months out of the year dealing with these people, I'm sure you start to see patterns, right? You start to see how they act. And for him, he said, he actually called aside the manager. He said, this security guy is no good. I want somebody else. He actually said that the night of the attack at Bataclan Theater in France on the 11th of November last year. And he said that the backstage door was open. You know, I can understand why he'd be pretty, pretty put off by this. So he said, yeah, it was an inside job. The other thing that upset, the other thing that really upset people was that he thought he heard people cheering outside of the theater, that he thought he heard people celebrating. You know, whether he heard that correctly or not, who knows? I mean, he was an eyewitness, and I think we can only go based on that. But that was just so upsetting to people. And then they also dug up. So he was, you know, lambasted in the French press for this. And then they started to say, well, you know, he's also part of an extremist group that's in favor of arming the public. You know, they're talking about the NRA, right? And then I explained to them, I'm like, look, guys, you know, the NRA is like, you know, supported by a lot of people in America, a lot of people, you know, millions and millions, tens of millions, if not hundreds of millions. And, you know, you'd find a pretty significant number of, a vast majority of Republicans, and also a pretty good chunk of the Democrats are people who are owning guns, who are part of, you know, participate in gun culture, and who use them positively. And then, you know, they kind of chuckle and they're like, yeah, I guess, you know, one of them was like, yeah, I guess, you know, America is such a different place that these kind of comparisons don't really hash out, you know. But yeah, I mean, that's a sense of like how dishonest the French media can be about America. And so for Trump, you know, you're not going to get any context on anything he says. You're going to get the smallest snippet, and you're going to have a language barrier. So you're not going to be able to dig deeper. And also when it comes to people who are invited on the show to discuss American politics, you're never going to have anyone who is taking Trump's side, as you would in the American press or the British press, right? They would be able to invite somebody on to say, like, all right, give us the other perspective. And so you end up with a total echo chamber. I think it was, 4 years ago, they tried to do the same thing with Sarah Palin, saying like, oh, Sarah Palin's a total idiot and Marine Le Pen is like our Sarah Palin. And I think they're going to try to do the same thing. They're going to be like, look at Trump. Look at how we've, you know, this caricature we've created of him in the French press, right? Look at what he's like. This is what Marine Le Pen is like. And you don't want her running this country. You don't want him running America. So don't support them. So unlike Brexit, I think that it's kind of a wild card to say if the Trump phenomenon would be positive in the French mind or not. It's certainly a tool for those who are anti-FN.
Right, right. That's unfortunate. But the best evidence that something is possible is to see that it's actual, right? That it's happened.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And the best evidence for a Le Pen presidency would be a Trump presidency, given that there are some similarities. And clearly there are some real similarities.
Yeah.
And even more so, the left media loves to try and draw these parallels, tries to point out similarities to scare people, basically.
Yep. Yeah, and that's but at the end of the day, how many people make their decision based on that? Who knows?
Right.
But what you said about, you know, seeing the potential in the actual, back in November, I gave a talk and I was very skeptical as to whether Trump could win. And you know what I was thinking? I was thinking back to Sharon Angle. She ran for Senate against Harry Reid. And this was, I think, in 2010. So it was a year that normally, you know, all things being equal, is usually a good year for the party that is opposite the president's party, right? The second year of a presidency. Usually a president will lose seats in the Congress and the Senate in these years. On top of that, the Tea Party was, you know, roaring. Obamacare was deeply unpopular with a good number of people in America, and it hadn't even started yet. You know, so no one had anything to go on yet, but it was deeply unpopular. Those who were later depend on it were not depending on it. And also it was fresh off of the Bush attempts at amnesty, which were hugely unpopular, particularly in the Southwest. And Sharon Angle lost. And it seemed like, from the outside, it seemed like it was really hers to lose, that on the issues, she should have had that election. And so it almost seemed like, okay, not to mention that, the economic crisis was still roiling, it seemed like, okay, white people are just not going to come out for politically incorrect stuff. They're just too afraid. Their inner critic or inner, cultural Marxist is so strong that even in the privacy of a voting booth, they won't vote their own interests if someone's explicitly pursuing their own interests. And, but recently the failure of Eric Cantor, former Speaker of the House of Republicans, to win in a primary election in Virginia, showed that was not the case. And now, of course, with Trump, it's definitely not the case. So this is really a sea change. And I was definitely really happy to see it. Yeah. I think those in France, obviously those in France who can go on, understand English media, understand the American situation, are very positive about Trump. But yeah, those who are, don't quite get it, they don't speak English, they only get their new information from French press, they don't have the full picture.
That sounds reasonable. So let's wrap up. We have a few minutes before we hit an hour. So do you have some closing thoughts on these topics? The terrorism issue, the prospects of the Front National, knock-on effects of Brexit and the Trump election and so forth. Maybe in France, but also in Europe, overall, because there's been a lot of movement, a lot of positive movement in our direction in Europe recently.
Yeah.
With the Austrian election, for instance. So are you feeling high energy?
Yeah. I don't know if we're going to solve this through peaceful democratic means. I think that with France and Europe in general, I've said that this can be solved without, in France, this can be solved without changing the constitution, without any, violence, with just an orderly, lawful approach if Marine Le Pen is elected president. And if it's not the case, then we're going to have to see, temporary caretaker governments, situations approaching civil war, things like this. But I still believe that we'll be able to face down this challenge as a people. It's a question of how soon and how peaceful, or how late and how bloody. And even if Trump wins, it's the beginning of something very good, but it's not the finishing of it. I'm feeling very positive, feeling very good. If Marine Le Pen loses this time, I don't think that all hope is lost, but just the way that we're going to have to win is going to be different. And I really believe that the younger generation, you said recently on a Red Ice Radio podcast, how it's, how humbling it is to see the level of, quality of work, creativity, humor, dedication, from the younger crowd, that it's just a, blooming, it's just an explosion. It's come out of nowhere. Think about, was it Right Wing Death Squad Entertainment, Murdoch and Murdoch, these guys who make the cartoons, of course, the Daily Show and their crowd. They're a little bit older, but they've got a lot of young listeners, a lot of, young people making memes. Yeah, I have a lot of confidence in the younger generation, and that, you know, our movement will be much more numerous amongst them. And, I have faith that they're going to see it through to the end if I don't live to see it through to the end.
Yeah, I think that we're going to see the end of this. I think that it's going to end in our lifetime, and I think that we'll win. I didn't really think that 10 years ago. I didn't think that this would happen within my lifetime, but things are accelerating a bit.
Yeah.
We know for a fact that the present system is unsustainable. So the only question is not whether it's going to fail, but how it's going to fail, and if we can pick up the pieces once it fails, or if we can push it over the edge and have a smooth transition. That's really the only choice. I like the way Vox Day is always framing this. He says, look, you can go with the moderate, sensible nationalists or the really scary nationalists, but nationalism is ultimately, in the long term, the only choice here.
Yeah.
And I agree with that completely. In the long term, they're going to fail, and a healthier form of society will succeed. I hope it's not the healthy, primitive, deeply anti-European barbarism of the Islamic world. Islam is a growing militant religion because it is vital. You know, it's not decadent like the West. It's a vital religion. Unfortunately, it's also a profoundly barbaric and backward and destructive one.
Yeah. Yeah, there's a strategy, I've called it the girls just want to have fun strategy, that the elites in France have all bought into. And that is that, yeah, if we let them live a decadent life and go out to parties and so on, that they'll change. You know, there's a study done recently that I think 10% of the children of immigrants will revert to Orthodox Islam when their parents, in cases where their parents were not Orthodox practicing Muslims.
Right.
You know, I've never, and of course you think about those who are Orthodox practicing Muslims, and if their retention rate of ideology is anything like it is with white people, which I believe is, I've seen stuff that around 80% of children grow up to have the same, you know, religious political values of their parents.
Right.
So if I've never run the numbers on this, but if you put those two together, and if you think that, take into account that most white countries in Europe will have a below replacement fertility rate, that's not a winning strategy. The girls just want to have fun strategy is not a winning strategy. You might see, you know, minor victories, apparent victories in the meantime, but over the century, this is going to fail.
We know that second generation Muslims are more radical and anti-Western than their parents' generation. That's a pattern that's been attested to across Europe. The more they're exposed to European Western decadence, the more they hate it and want to go to Plan J. That's simply a fact.
Yeah.
You know, we're not going to corrupt them out of their religion. It's not a good strategy. So we need to come up with another strategy. And the best strategy, of course, is just to send them all away. And I think that is what will happen eventually. We're going to end up sending all of these people back. They have to go back. There is no reason for any non-whites to be on the soil of Europe.
Yeah.
No reason whatsoever.
Yeah, well, as the younger guys who were just praising earlier would say, that would be the remove kebab strategy.
Yeah, we just need to remove kebab.
That's it, yeah.
And they'll be gone. And yes, the only question is how. Not whether, but how. And I think that all options are on the table. All options have to be on the table.
Absolutely.
And we have to be realistic about this. France has a long, illustrious history of coups and revolutions and violent changes of government and strong men leaders. And it might be time for a strong woman leader. Well, there was Joan of Arc.
That's right.
Past too.
That's right. And every year, you know, the FN rallies to the Joan of Arc statue.
Right.
This is kind of a quick aside before really concluding, but that's the thing about there's a political landscape of monuments in Paris, and it's deeply meaningful. And there are a few places that belong to us, in Paris, and that we'll continue to, and that we, and that the flame has been kept alive, by, you know, a lot of really good folks, really well-meaning folks. And thank goodness they did, because I think that we're going to see that flame become a roaring fire, and it will, it will burn the asses of all these guys invading us now. The, if I was a conspiracy theorist, you know, which, I would say that, if I was one of these people that believe that the elites have, you know, really long plans and they're playing these like deep strategies against the people, I would think that this was some kind of way to bring in the European Union as a totally united political structure. They break down our national borders, they fill us with a common enemy, and then we have to band together to fight them and remove them. And then we feel like brothers from the Atlantic to the Urals. I don't think that they're that clever. I don't think our elites are that clever. But I do think that that is a very big possibility, that you'll still have a very vibrant local cultures, but that through a common struggle, I think that a European identity will be emerge that's stronger than ever, and that is, stronger than it has been since the Battle of Lepanto and the Battle of Vienna. And that can only be a good thing and a really hopeful beacon that we're heading towards right now.
Well, Patrick, thank you very much. That's a really nice high-energy ending, and we will continue this conversation soon, I hope.
Great. Thank you so much. Talk to you soon.